We can teach our machine to learn them faster than a human. So the expert system is guided down the path of AI learning by the professional until we get to a point where the features are beyond human perception. And that's the point at which AI takes over in an iterative manner, but this can happen incredibly fast.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, the host of Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the impact of intellectual property rights on people and business. Season 3 spotlights such topics as artificial intelligence, IP licensing, and TikTok as a learning tool. Enjoy the episode. Artificial intelligence has been around for decades. Sometimes known as fuzzy logic or smart systems, advances in chip design and software have imbued it with superpowers. Pioneering physicist, bioengineer, and serial entrepreneur Alan C. Nelson is CEO of VisionGate, which has developed the first AI-driven platform for cell analysis for early-stage detection of lung, prostate, and breast cancers. Dr. Nelson was founder and CEO of Neopath, the only fully automated AI-driven platform to detect cervical cancer. Neopath was sold for $107 million in 1999, and its products are marketed today by Becton Dickinson. These successes did not come easily. The science, he says, was less daunting than some of the agencies responsible for approving them. Dr. Nelson has held professorships at Arizona State University, the University of Washington, MIT, and Harvard. He has been using AI techniques in research since the 1990s, and he has more than 100 peer-reviewed publications in the field of biomedical imaging. He holds 142 patents and is a fellow in the National Academy of Inventors. Good morning, Dr. Nelson. It's really an honor to have you with us today on Understanding IP Matters. May I call you Alan?
Yes, of course.
Where are you speaking from today?
I'm speaking from my home office in Gig Harbor, Washington.
You started out as a physicist at UC Berkeley, and that's where you studied. And you found your way into bioengineering. It's kind of an interesting path. How did that happen? And where did your interest in applying AI to diagnostics develop?
First, Bruce, I want to thank you for allowing me to join this conversation. And I have to start the story just a wee bit before Berkeley. The continuous development of my interest in AI, if you will, began just before I went to Berkeley for graduate school. I went to work for a very interesting organization called Xerox Electron Optical Systems in Pasadena, California, so-called EOS, with a small group of engineers and physicists who were developing a breast cancer screening technology. That's my first exposure to diagnostic imaging. And that was an interesting story. The technology was wildly successful. Xerox, using their electrostatic technology, developed an imaging capability that would allow visualization of breast microcalcifications that precede tumor formation in breast cancer. So this could have been predictive of breast cancer. And actually, my first patent, the first patent in my life, was with Xerox on that.
And that's different from Xerox PARC.
This group reported to Xerox PARC. So it was an R&D sort of think tank kind of organization. So it was not located with Xerox PARC, but it was part of that organization. The reason I bring that up is because the microcalcifications generally cannot be seen in normal breast X-ray mammography, thus touching on the need for image processing and maybe some AI. But this was before we even understood automatic measurement and image interpretation. Nevertheless, that interest guided me toward the application of physics in imaging technologies. Berkeley was a thrilling experience for me. The enthusiasm and bright ideas of so many physicists at Berkeley,
and Robert Oppenheimer, right?
Yeah. I wish I could have met him. Einstein before that. But it was a thrilling group of open-minded, big-thinking physicists. And that guided me to many things. And I was working on the Hill, as it was called, or Lawrence Radiation Lab, as it was called back then, to use heavy ion particle beams to treat glioblastoma of the brain. And this technology actually worked. It's just that you can't replicate that accelerator anywhere in the world for any sort of economic reasons. And therefore, it's not a viable treatment except for the rare research cases. Image processing, image analysis, reading radiological and cellular and scanning electron microscopy images, collect data, but more importantly, to assess the value of the data and the quality of the data.
How is the use of AI and machine learning today different from, say, back in the 90s when it was just sort of, it was fuzzy logic?
Well, it's totally different in an evolutionary sort of way, in the following sense that back then in the 90s, we didn't have bandwidth on the internet. We didn't have massive economic data storage capability. We did not have cloud computing. None of those things existed. And yet, with the tools we had, we still move forward, albeit on a slower, smaller, more economic scale. As you point out, beginning with things like you could visualize, which might include fuzzy logic, binary tree, classification of data, to come to some kind of knowledge conclusion. Now, it's truly remarkable. Just take a deep breath, and we can manage terabytes of data in seconds. We can move it all up into the cloud where we actually never know where it is. But in the cloud is a massive amount of computational capability, almost unlimited, at least from my point of view, with regard to applications that me and my team think about. And the computing is economic, fast, and very high bandwidth, and packed with data. We have access to unlimited amounts of data.
Generative AI, which is much talked about, large language learning models, that's often confused with machine learning. And you're not really talking about generative AI when you're speaking about AI, are you? There is some overlap, but there's a difference.
Big difference. But I think in the future, even that difference will become fuzzy. So I'm oversimplifying, but generative AI is the ability to create from all of the resources that we have available for information, computing, et cetera, including creating artwork, including creating prose and poetry and on the creative effort, including the possibility of a machine creating an invention, which would be kind of interesting, IP generation, if you will. And that is different from what me and my technologies and companies do, which is applications or machine learning, as you point out, to do automated diagnosis. So there's a knowledge creation to answer a question rather than create the question and create the answer. And so the work that I do is not generative AI, as you say, but it is diagnostic information creation AI. But I think in the future, there's going to be a fuzzy line between those two as well, because diagnostic areas evolve over time. The knowledge base and the ability of professionals to perform better diagnoses changes over time. And I believe that cognitive evolution may actually merge with generative AI going forward. Today, I see it as two distinct areas of AI, but I recognize that may not be persistent.
AI inventions were and still are today often misunderstood by agencies like USPTO, the Federal Trade Commission, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and other government agencies. Why do you think that is the case, that they have a difficult time with AI?
I'll be careful with the word difficult, because they're very smart people. There's no doubt about it. But the definition of AI evolves. And you pointed out a while back that it used to be fuzzy logic. And we didn't even call it AI, but that's a beginner's form of statistical relevant decision making. This field is moving very, very quickly. Tomorrow, there'll be new technologies that evolve faster than many people, including academics, can keep up with. You know, always one step behind, perhaps, whoever is leading the industry. So that would apply to federal agencies as well. With regard to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, we have found that it can be very useful if we, my teams, happen to be leading certain AI inventions going forward, to arrange with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to come and deliver a seminar. And they welcome that opportunity. Doors are open, you know, they take lunch breaks. And so me and my patent attorneys, I'm supervised during this process, go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and deliver lectures, typically to an audience of 20 or 30 willing and interested examiners who participate and ask a lot of questions. It's highly interactive, and it becomes a learning process.
It's great they're willing to listen.
I'd say willing and eager. With regard to the FDA, it's a little more difficult in the sense that you typically can't just call the FDA and say, I want to come and deliver a seminar. However, you can meet with a group of FDA reviewers and discuss the value of AI. And I will say there that there are other interesting constraints that have nothing to do with intellectual property per se, but they have to do with the FDA agency's need to fully understand, debug, and predict outcomes in software applications involving algorithms and AI. And this leads to a bit of a rub with the FDA, and that has to do with neural networks that traditionally, some of the first were hardware form. And if you made a decision with a neural network, it might be accurate, but you don't know how the decision was made. And if it's a wrong decision, it's not straightforward to figure out how to fix it. And the FDA has heartburn over that kind of question. And so something like a binary tree fuzzy logic classifier that you can write down and visualize, even though it may have 1,000 layers of decisions and be very complex, is understandable by the FDA. But a neural network is not, and never will be. And so there are certain things you cannot do with a decision technology that you can't debug and you can't understand from the FDA point of view, even though you could get a patent on it.
So how do you deal with that? Or how have you dealt with it?
That's led to a lot of interesting issues, especially when you add to that question, what is the gold standard? And so I have a history in my companies of building diagnostic machines. As you mentioned, one of them was for cervical cancer. That required 2 class 3 PMA approvals by the FDA, good and bad. First, good, that's the highest possible bar for the FDA. Bad, that it took 30,000 patients to do that clinical study. That's the largest clinical study that I'm aware of ever conducted by the FDA. Well, that is a lot of time and expense. And the result of that is the technology doesn't get to market to help people for a very long time. There's an impact of that. But the gold standard question, which I think now the FDA is becoming a little more comfortable with, has to do with what if a machine is better than a human? And that's not no-brainer. And we can build machines that indeed are better than humans. But the human is the gold standard from the FDA, particularly with regard to diagnostics. But the human is not regulated by the FDA. So if you go to the FDA and say, I am building a machine that is more sensitive to lung cancer than a pathologist, and it makes fewer false positive mistakes than a pathologist, the FDA might say, yeah, but the pathologist is the gold standard. And how do you do a clinical study when we don't know what the sensitivity and false positive rate of a pathologist is? It's just accepted. That's current medical practice, and the FDA doesn't regulate that. So the issue is now compounded by the need to also prove what is the gold standard. Don't just accept it, but prove what it is, and then you're allowed to prove that you're better.
Very interesting. You recently told an audience at the 7th Intellectual Property Awareness Summit held by the Center for IP Understanding, organization that I work with at Northwestern University, there is a tidal wave of AI and healthcare that is coming faster and bigger than most people think. And there's going to be some panic around that. What did you mean by that?
Thank you for quoting back to me. And by the way, that was a very exciting conference bringing to the attention of the audience many critical activities going on in AI and IP, and so it goes. And thank you for that. The comment is this, that healthcare is merging data sets across many fields. This is possible without revealing patient identity, so we can all be HIPAA compliant, so to speak. But nevertheless, we can begin to correlate massive amounts of data amongst different demographics and globally that we could never do before. And with that power, we can begin to predict interventions and outcomes. And we have the computational capability to do that as well. And if an intervention involves a new technology, including AI technologies, including patentable new technologies, that can evolve very quickly. And what we find is that the ability, and I focus mostly on diagnosis, to improve diagnostic capabilities for, let's say, cancer early detection, where interventions actually have a dramatically improved impact on the patient's life, can change, you know, at a pace that we've never seen before. And that's a very, very exciting wave. You know, I look at the giant 100-foot waves that come into northern Hawaii and think about surfing one of those waves. And if you're a technologist, you literally have that wave. And you're trying in your niche to stay hooked into it and take advantage of the momentum and the volume. And it's breathtaking to keep up with that. Now, the challenge to healthcare is that we're beginning to escape conventional ways of thinking about diagnosis and patient management and even drug development for improved therapeutic opportunities. And again, this is happening at a breathtaking speed enabled by the high bandwidth internets and also cloud computing and massive data storage. So this is, I think, a good time. However, I think it needs to be managed and regulated.
By the way, your talk, your excellent talk, AI-driven early cancer detection opportunities and challenges at the event, the IP Awareness Summit, that's going to be available in a couple of weeks on YouTube. That will drop, and we'll put out an announcement for that. But everyone who was unable to attend and those who were want to hear it again can do so. You enlisted Congresswoman Patty Murray from your home state, Washington, to help take your case to the House of Representatives. How did that happen, and what was the result?
That was a dark day where Patty Murray, the senator from Washington, shed some light on a very interesting situation. And that was with regard to FDA approval for a machine that screened pap smears to detect cervical cancer and could diagnose cervical cancer. As a technology innovator, I didn't fully appreciate that the FDA actually, in its whole history, had never approved a machine to diagnose cancer. And again, from a technology point of view, I understood how that could happen, but I'd appreciate what an enormous challenge that might be for a regulatory agency that's in charge of, you know, health and avoiding harms from new technologies. As we entered the FDA for Class 3 PMA panel hearing to deliver our data, which was, I thought at the time, pretty impressive, we had to cross a picket line. And I thought, this is a bad timing, a bad sign. Cafeteria workers are picketing just like they do in France. But as we went through the line, that realized that the picketers were actually pathologists, MDs carrying signs saying, don't approve this technology. We don't want to lose our jobs. And what that did for me is start my brain rolling on a speech I might have to give the FDA, which says, basically, sometimes it's important to trade a job for a woman's life. And that's kind of non-science drama. And in fact, when we got to the FDA, the panel itself was 20 pathologists, and they did not approve the technology. And I believe had nothing to do with the quality of the science. And so I got to give my speech. It was Patty Murray who picked up on that issue and took me to Capitol Hill and opened the doors of the women of Congress and many MD congressional leaders, and allowed for Congress actually to draft a letter to the FDA.
What year was this?
1996. And again, it's a reflection more of the fact that the FDA just had never seen before a machine to do a diagnosis, when they thought that job of a pathologist, and the pathologist is the gold standard, and how can you be better than that? But the machine is better, dramatically better. And happily, ultimately, that machine did get approved by the FDA and has become a global method of doing pap smear screening in countries that do not have sufficient pathology training anyway to screen pap smears.
You started life out, Alan, as an academic, physicist and bioengineer. How did you become an entrepreneur? That's sort of a different hat, and a successful one at that. Was it difficult raising capital for radically new inventions?
I always had an interest in applied physics. So when you say physics, yes, I love theory, I love mathematics, but I always wanted to apply the physics that I knew to something useful, even just tool development. But going back to Xerox, as I mentioned earlier, my first exposure to mammography for the detection of breast cancer, I realized that there's an interesting role in physics for applied sciences that actually lead immediately to healthcare benefits. This just has been a big motivator for me personally to take the physics, biophysics, and bioengineering that I've learned to have immediate impact in healthcare, particularly in the cancer arena. So that's been a central motivation for me. And as a result of that, as a professor, what I am known to do is recruit a terrific, brilliant group of graduate students and take them with me, and even help them finish their PhDs while they're in my new companies and commercialize. And universities, in my opinion, are decent people for tech transfer, but, you know, they don't commercialize. And I realize if you want to have impact, you need to commercialize a product. And everything I do is FDA regulated, and so there are multiple hurdles. Did I have difficulty raising money? Yes and no. I had difficulty dealing with the people that had the money, but really didn't. It's challenging, absolutely challenging for sure. But I would say raising money is always hard, but it's something that can be done. And in my pap smear screening company, We raised over $100 million back in the 90s. And in a VisionGate company for lung cancer, we've raised over $75 million privately, mostly angels, interestingly.
And you're inclined not to transfer the technology to a big pharma company or a big diagnostics company, but to develop it yourself and maybe eventually sell the company.
Yes, although my Pashmir company went public and then got sold. But yes, we're a small team of people driven by a mission that speaks to them loud and clear every second of the day can be incredibly efficient. And so, for example, we've probably accomplished in VisionGate with $75 million, the creation of a brand new platform called the Cell CT. And I happen to know that one of the large companies that developed X-ray CT back in the day spent $1 billion and 1,000 man years to do it. We've done it with $75 million. And I'm just saying that's a scale of efficiency. And entrepreneurialism is the spirit that kind of backs that. And every single employee has that spirit. But there comes a point with regard to scaling where the game changes dramatically. And it's no longer invention and innovation and engineering and development, but rather get onto the path of regulated quality systems for manufacturing and clinical trials and FDA, where a much larger organization is required. And so somewhere in there is a tipping point where having the company acquired by a larger corporation expedites and improves the quality of the final outcome.
It's difficult for small companies when the cost becomes so exorbitant that they can no longer take the products to market on their own. The technology, instead of looking at cells through microscope, the Cell CT allows VisionGate to take 500 images of every cell and create a three-dimensional image, your website says. What role does AI play in that, in taking those 500 images and processing them?
It's the processing them that involves the AI, getting to the 3D images, all data collection and computation. And that's a horrendous effort alone. But you talked about the output of the Cell CT, which is a three-dimensional cell at 200 nanometers resolution with 2 gigabytes of data in one cell. And we may need 10,000 cells to do a diagnosis. And so you can just multiply that out and you're into terabytes of data before you know it. Now, the interesting thing is that we use 2 levels of training. One is expert systems training, where we allow pathologists to see the new 3D cell, that the likes of which they've never seen before, compare that to their standard method of doing diagnosis, and guide the expert system to make the right decision after measuring nearly 1,000 different features in that data set. The beginning, we don't know for sure which features are more meaningful than others. And the pathologists start the AI in the right direction. But then we pick up on AI to complete the learning, because the system actually detects features that pathologists have never seen before. So they too would have to learn the new features, but we can teach our machine to learn them faster than a human. So the expert system is guided down the path of AI learning by the professional until we get to a point where the features are beyond human perception. And that's the point at which AI takes over in an iterative manner, but this can happen incredibly fast, to complete the optimal performance of the diagnostic capability. So it's an interesting blend of expert systems and expert guided learning, ultimately to set the trajectory toward an accurate diagnosis, where new features now are utilized by the machine and machine learning to complete the process without the expert guiding it any further, because they are not familiar with these additional measurements that are beyond visual capability.
I would imagine there are other companies working on similar approaches.
I would say yes and no. The no part is that I don't see a lot of companies doing exactly what I just described. But again, that's what I don't see, but it might be there. What I do see are pursuits, particularly in genomics, where, again, the disease itself, if a pathologist is making the determination, is actually discoverable through gene sequencing that the pathologist cannot see. So there are similarities there. That is a data set that is different from what a pathologist normally uses and needs to be correlated with the diagnostic outcome. And so the process I described, where AI can be involved in driving the correct analysis, is very much there for the utilization of other omics, if you will, like genomics and proteomics.
You're responsible for, I think, 142 patents. Have the patents played an important role in either defending or developing or licensing your technology? Without the patents, would you have succeeded as well as you have?
They're critical. I guess that's the shortest answer. And the reason is that the patents nowadays give us a 20-year horizon in a field of technology that is changing at a much more rapid pace. So nowadays, 20 years is a very long time. And had we not had patents, I think there would always be the question of, can you protect your space? Even if you're first to market, you've shown and guided the way to get there, and others in an attractive market will soon be there, even if you're the technology leader and the innovator in the space. And no, we would not have gotten funded to develop our commercial effort, ultimately, if we didn't have patent protection to assure investors that we had some period of time to be the industry leader and potentially dominate the industry before competition would be at our backs. And we have both been sued for supposed patent infringement, and we won, by the way, and we've actually never sued anybody for patent infringement, partly because I think we create a fearful wall of patent protection. Be scary. And the last thing a little entrepreneurial company wants really is patent litigation. It's a huge distraction and it's expensive. And so my theory is put up a patent wall that is so frightening to any competitor that they're just not going to go there. And therefore, we don't have to worry about litigation.
What key points would you want to leave with listeners today?
Well, if listeners are feeling entrepreneurial, I absolutely want to embolden every entrepreneur. That means don't hesitate to try to implement big ideas that may be paradigm changing, that may be a global shift in the way healthcare is done. Think big. And as you think big, think about intellectual property, because everybody's going to need funding to create the opportunity to commercialize those big ideas. And so big ideas should be implemented, they should be put to practice, and you should go immediately to the patent office. And truly, if you're a thought leader, go to the patent office and deliver a lecture, educate the examiners, and build your patent wall.
What are your thoughts about the march-in rights that are proposed for pharmaceuticals and vaccines and other life-saving approaches?
The march-in right is the federal government stepping in to say we're going to take that technology and use it as we see fit, to oversimplify. I've personally been involved in that. In my pap smear screening company, we developed a new kind of imputer because GPUs like GeForce and NVIDIA that everybody uses these days were not available then. And so we had to develop a chip. And thus, semiconductors are quite sensitive for federal government agencies. And we got marched in, which means that our company was shut down. while the federal government examined exactly what are we doing in this space, and when they realized that our chip designs were locked and going to be utilized in the healthcare space, we did get permission. However, we were forbidden from carrying this technology to certain countries at that time. It's good and bad. If it happens, it means you truly are an innovator creating something of potential great value to the government. But the government can, if you're not careful, block that technology.
Great. Well, thank you, Alan. This was really enlightening. Appreciate your perspective on artificial intelligence, which is a three-decade perspective. We'll have to continue our conversation. This should be a beginning, not an end.
Well, I've enjoyed this conversation, Bruce, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for IP Understanding, an independent nonprofit. Follow CIPU on LinkedIn at the Center for Intellectual Property. Content conveyed is for informational purposes only and does not represent the views of CIPU or its affiliates. This episode was produced by Jack Shields for Wild Creek Studios.